Thank you for listening to the Following Films podcast. Today I have two interviews. Up first, I'm joined by Jaden Martell and Maxwell Jenkins to discuss their work on the new Nicolas Cage starring film Arcadian. The film is set in the near future, where normal life on Earth has been decimated. Paul and his two sons, Thomas and Joseph, have been living a half-life, tranquility by day and torment by night. Every night after the sun sets, they face the unrelenting attacks of a mysterious and violent evil. One day, when Thomas doesn't return home before sundown, Paul must leave the safety of their fortified farm to find him. A nightmarish battle ensues that forces the family to execute a desperate plan to survive. Then after the break, I'm joined by Larry Fessenden to discuss his latest film, Blackout. Writer-director Larry Fessenden has created some of the most original and memorable independent horror films of the last 25 years. His latest, Blackout, ranks among the most chilling and thought-provoking of his works. In the film, when the sun goes down, Charlie has convulsions. While driving his car, he goes off the road and ends up in a ditch. Charlie, it seems, is a werewolf. He attacks his rescuers and moves through the outskirts of town at night, wreaking havoc. But the next day, he can't remember the things he's done. Now, the tight-knit town must rally to find out what's really tearing it apart. Mistrust, fear, or a vicious monster. I highly enjoyed and recommend both these films. Arcadian is in theaters now, and Blackout is available on VOD. Hope you enjoy the show. Thanks.
Thank you guys so much for taking the time to do this today. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
I was really struck by this film. This is a pretty rare post-apocalyptic film that felt incredibly internal and devoid of the normal wish fulfillment than you see it in a lot of films like this, where a lot of times it kind of, these films feel like, oh, when the world ends, I'm going to get to do all this badass shit. This is something that felt much more like a exploration of this family. Anybody that comes from dysfunction or trauma, I think, would see a lot to relate to in this film. And I'm just wondering if you could both talk about what attracted you to this project, because I personally think this is really a performance piece before it is a genre film.
Yeah, totally. That's awesome that you say that, because that's exactly what drew me to the film. That's why, there's so many, we have an infinite amount of stories and movies about monsters and people fighting back and saving the world, but here we have family who's thrown into this is their world, and they have to deal with it. They have to survive. And I loved finding out the details and how they did that, how they lock up and finding all of those practical things was super helpful as an actor to get into character and understand how these guys operate. But just B was just interesting to me, it's not about saving the world or conquering the monster. It's all about the love between these people and what they do for each other and how they also fuck up another flaw.
Absolutely. And there was something in the performances, especially with the three of you, but you two specifically, that I saw where it felt like sometimes in the cadence and the way that you delivered lines, there was mirroring to some degree, where it felt like, and I don't know if this was conscious or not, but there were certain things that I was picking up where it felt like the way a family talks to each other, that is, it's very subtle and small, but it was something that was deeper than just a physical or, they similar haircuts or anything like that. There was the way you delivered lines. It wasn't like you were imitating each other, but it felt like these were people with a shared language. Was that something that you were thoughtful about, trying to make that kind of performance connection amongst the three of you?
That's definitely Mike Nylon, the writer.
Yep.
And that's B, Ben.
Yeah.
It's also Nick.
Yep.
And him coming in and making things feel like, when he came to set, he kind of carried it in a way where it felt like we had been doing it for a long time. Mm-hmm. And everything became very habitual and like simple and like the way we communicate, everything's very quick to the point. We're three men, living in a house. It's like, that's really cool. That's really cool that you said that.
Yeah. I wish that, you know, take credit and say like, yeah, man, I was like taking notes all the time about the way Jaden says things, but I really do think it boils down to everything you said. Ben had a really consistent vision throughout that entire process of always bringing it down to him. Yes, he comes from this VFX background and he's a wildly talented creator in that realm, and he could create the most crazy worlds with the most crazy monsters, and he kind of did. But I think he really understood the family vehicle that drove the whole mechanism of monsters and scaries and cockroaches and all that. I think he really understood that it was the family carrying that forward. So we had limited rehearsal, but the rehearsal that we did was pretty much solely focused on establishing a family dynamic. It wasn't as much getting into the action sequences of it all. We had stunt rehearsals. We had a lot of those, but the stuff that we did with Ben was really focused on how do these brothers interact with each other? How are they going to interact with their dad? Mm-hmm. Really making that specific so that it didn't just seem like a generic brother or father relationship. It felt like their own unique thing. It's their family.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. This is from not only just the aesthetic of what you were talking about, the, you know, knowing how to make a film that looks good in VFX and those kinds of, it has all that for sure. But really, I think you could tear all of that out of this movie. You could remove all the genre elements. You could remove the monsters. You could remove any of that. And really at this heart, there's this family story that I think you could tell a version of this that's just a stage play, that it really is that much of a character piece. And it's pretty rare to see something like that these days that's that just thoughtful. And, you know, congratulations on it, guys. I know these are incredibly short interviews, and I could definitely go into this with a lot more depth and detail on it, but this is something I highly recommend people check out, because this is got a hell of a film here, guys.
Congratulations. Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
No, thanks. Absolutely. Thanks, guys. Take care. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Take care.
See you.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
This episode of the Following Films podcast is brought to you by Bookmans. So today, I went into Bookmans and decided to try to find a film by Michael Mann. I went over to the Blu-ray section and saw copies of several films I already own, and then I found it, Black Hat. This is one I haven't seen in quite a while since it came out, and I figured maybe it was time for a reassessment of this much maligned film. So Black Hat is a cybercrime thriller directed by Michael Mann that delves into the world of cybercrime, hacking, and international intrigue. While it promises to be a gripping exploration of the dangers lurking in the digital age, the execution falls short of expectations. The film follows convicted hacker played by Chris Hemsworth, who's temporarily released from prison to help the American and Chinese authorities track down a criminal network that's responsible for a series of major attacks. As the hunt takes them across the globe, Hemsworth's character must navigate the murky waters of the criminal underworld while grappling with his own demons. One of the film's major shortcomings is its lack of technical accuracy and realism. While it attempts to portray the world of hacking authentically, it often falls into cliches and inaccuracies that ultimately undermine the credibility of the story. So the hacking sequences are exaggerated and unrealistic, relying more on flashy visuals than genuine technical expertise. And this is coming from an absolute layman. I am not somebody who knows anything about hacking, and yet I can see some of the things that just flat out aren't true in this film. And that particular disconnect may disappoint viewers familiar with the subject matter or looking for a more grounded portrayal of cybercrime. So despite these flaws, though, Black Hat does have its moments. Michael Mann's signature style is evident in the film's beautiful, sleek cinematography and the signature action sequences, and the international setting adds depth to the narrative. It highlights the global nature of cyber threats and the challenges of international cooperation. Chris Hemsworth delivers a solid performance as Hathaway, bringing the character a sense of depth who's grappling for redemption. And the supporting cast includes, I had no idea, I'd completely forgotten this, but Viola Davis, who's
really great in the film and adds a lot to the film, but ultimately Black Hat falls short of its potential. While it offers a glimpse into the world of cybercrime and espionage, its lack of technical accuracy and reliance on cliches detracts from the overall experience. And despite its flaws, fans of Michael Mann's work or of the cyber thriller genre, I guess if you're a huge Johnny Mnemonic fan and you're looking for some more cyber thriller, you could do worse than Black Hat. However, for those seeking a more realistic, nuanced exploration of hacking and cybersecurity, this might leave you wanting more, and I'm not sure I can recommend this one. But despite that, this gave me the chance to check out a film that I've been meaning to reevaluate, because I keep hearing that Black Hat is an underrated film, and maybe I'll give it another 10 years, follow back up with this one, and see if it does end up coming around for me. But remember, Bookmans, they have your cool covered. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show. Thanks. Hey, Larry, thank you so much for taking the time to do this today, man. I really appreciate it.
Oh, for sure, dude. I'm looking at your room. I like your poster there, buddy.
Well, I mean, I'm a big fan. So Jen is one of the nicer people I've met in the film industry. She was just really cool. And I love seeing her stuff and love seeing the sort of trajectory of her career. So yeah, and the Rangers, I love that poster so much. So.
Right. And Jen is amazing. She really gave Glass Eye an extra 10 years. I was ready to throw in the towel. She came, she produced a bunch of great movies for us. And then she made The Ranger, and we let her out the door. But great kindred spirit.
Yeah, she's one of the good ones. She's a good egg for sure. So, I mean, the timing of this, man, couldn't be more perfect. We're literally in the middle of an eclipse right now outside. And so is it serendipity? Is this by design? Just that you're talking to folks like in the middle of a solar eclipse right now?
I love that. It's so true. The moon is asserting itself.
Yeah, it's a great time to be talking about werewolves. And I'm just wondering, do you have, like me personally, I was a monster kid. The Universal monsters, loved them growing up. And I've always been attracted to those stories, because even through like the Hammer stuff and these things throughout every decade, every, you know, couple of years, it seems like people take these monsters and reinterpret them. And did you have sort of a similar relationship with these classic monsters as well?
Absolutely. I was obsessed with the Universal movies. And, you know, the Wolfman is the most respected in those movies, because even in the later ones with the mashups, and you've got, you know, Bela Lugosi with the squished head and all, you know, all the stuff the kids remember, and Glenn Strange was actually really cool as the monster. But the point is that it was always Chaney who was the Wolfman, and his stories were the most sort of anguished and the most relatable, because he was obviously dealing with his curse and always moaning and groaning about, kill me now or I'm going to find a cure, you know. So there was a desperation to his particular character. But I also read comic book called Werewolf by Night. That was Marvel.
It's in the 70s or late 60s, something like that. I can't remember.
They had Tomb of Dracula and they had the Monster of Frankenstein, and most of the early ones were drawn by Mike Ploog. His werewolf was very relatable to a young sort of a teenage kid, because it was a young man who would turn into this really cool werewolf with, a flat face, by the way. But, that was great, because your imagination was filling in. It was just a drawn image, but it was another world that mattered to me, even more than the Hammer films. But and then obviously we had the 80s where they changed the makeup conceit and we all got to enjoy all of those amazing effects. And then that was another, but werewolves remain less popular than vampires, obviously, and so on. So they're kind of sweet. You know, what's a good one is, am I going to remember? It's about the kid in the wheelchair.
Silver Bullet, the Stephen King one. Yeah.
And Gary Busey is amazing in that.
So good. Yeah. It's
really charming, and you know, the kid is really appealing in the whole thing. I don't like the monster, but you don't see him until the end, and it's not really as important. It's funny, some people review my film and say there's not enough monster, but I'm sorry, that's the whole weird thing about werewolves. It's the curse hanging over you, and then you get it for 2 days out of the month. So in a way, it's built into that storyline, for better or worse. But
I actually like the amount that you use the monster here. I actually really appreciate the design of it. I think you have something really unique with your monster design here. Yeah, I mean, give me more monster. I'm always going to be fine with that. You could spend an hour and a half with the monster and I'd be cool.
but you distract from the reason that I think I'm attracted to these stories. Like you said, it's, you project the idea of sort of the inner turmoil of the, you know, you're dealing with alcoholism, you're dealing with, you know, trauma and all these things that come through that, that it's, yeah, werewolf stories are never really werewolf stories at the end. They're not really monster stories.
Yeah. Well, all monster stories aren't monster
stories.
Yeah,
true.
You know, even Frankenstein, you're so connected to that performance from that movie. And then, you know, almost always he's slightly more sympathetic than the other monsters. If they're grouping them, it's funny, even up to the, what was that, Van Helsing, you know, the Frankenstein, yeah. Very sympathetic, goofy. So that's what I'm sort of, when I talk about Blackout and even my other efforts like Depraved as a Frankenstein.
Yeah, movie, for sure.
They speak to you. They have a personality. It's just for you to sort of decide how you're going to present it. But you're already dealing with, they're like Greek myths, you know, Zeus had one thing going and Apollo had another thing or whoever. And that's kind of what this monster verse that Universal started. And it's in all mediums, as I say, you know, Stephen King has done his, although funnily enough, he also likes the Wendigo. It's in Pet Sematary. So
yeah, it's a good one. I mean, there's so much cross-pollination with these stories too, where they had their own inspiration outside of that. These didn't come from nowhere. These stories, they're stories that we've been telling for hundreds of years now. So it didn't start in the 1920s or 1930s.
That's right. Although it is interesting with the Wolfman, and I'm terrible with names, but his name is Zodiac or something. Anyway, he wrote the story and he came up with a full moon and all this other stuff that you take for granted now, because that wasn't the seminal book like Dracula and Frankenstein. You know all this, but yeah. I just out loud, it's fun to think about the origins of all these creatures, you know.
Well, let's talk a little bit specifically about yours, though. And we touched on it briefly, but the getting the monster right was clearly something that was important to you. And I feel like you have your own Wolfman in this one. And in fact, you have multiple makeup designs here that you're using. And I love the way you handled the transformation also. I think it was something that I haven't seen before in this specific way. And I thought you really did add something new to the conversation.
Wonderful. I appreciate that. And I also like that you notice, like, the Wolfman looks different in each iteration. And it's, yeah. You know, we weren't fetishizing that, but, you know, I would let it happen. And I was so excited. I mean, the first thing is the casting of Alex Hurt. You know, he was a very interesting and sensitive and somewhat wounded fellow. I met him on my son's movie and when I was producing a little war film called Foxhole. Mm-hmm. And Alex was in it, and he was a great actor. But also off camera, we would talk about his love of monsters and his relationship to his father. And there were just so many of, and his alcoholism for that matter. So, you know, long past, but the point is that there were these touchstones and I'm like, I'm actually talking to my werewolf. This is amazing. I've got the movie. So, you know, the moment when I said, I'm going to actually go forward and do it. And then I worked with Brian Spears and Peter Gerner on the makeup. And I said, there's no conversation. It's flat face. And I would give them the Werewolf by Night drawings or, you know, the comic. But even with Alex, you know, the movement, all of those things was building this idea of the visuals of the character. And I mean, my favorite things the Wolfman does in my movies, just when he's running, you know,
yeah.
It would be a, you know, you definitely have to do your killing. You know, you have your obligations as a werewolf, but you'd also just be like, running around, you know. That was also part of it. But, you know, he got so buff at my request that I realized we don't need to put him in a little fur suit. It's only going to ruin what we've got.
Yeah.
And we played with the reality that it was about, it's a psychological movie. It's about a really troubled dude. And when he visits his girlfriend, spoiler alert, you know, it's a home invasion by your old boyfriend. It's not just a werewolf scene.
Yes.
So I want the movie to always be playing on those two planes as best I could do it.
And it's something, though, where the scenes on first watch, they're not what they appear to be throughout the entire film, where things, there's a different context that's added to it that actually adds a layer that's something that's completely unique to this one. That I really dug that about this one, that it's not just this straightforward dealing with trauma, that there is a level of a wounded person trying to make things right throughout this film, that you don't see it right away. And I love that.
I really appreciate that. You know, one thing is you make, well, this is just a slightly outside of the genre movie. It doesn't have every expectation delivered on. And it's why I put the werewolf on the poster. I'm like, I don't want to fetishize you know, the moment will I reveal something that then you'll go, meh, you know, I want you to already know what you're getting into. So you're going to start reading the movie at a different level, not some deep level, but just like engage with it differently, you know? And it is the worry is that if someone doesn't get that, then they're not impressed because they're having trouble finding why am I watching this movie? It's, you know, and then they talk about the budget and all these other excuses. But the reality is that I'm interested in this sort of everyday dilemmas that a character is going through with the sort of the imposition of a mythological aspect. And it's sort of my relationship to life. You know, you're always aware of, well, if you're insane like me, you know, of death.
Yeah.
Everything feels volatile. And I'm trying to put people into that headspace, which is how I feel, as if I was a killing werewolf at night.
Well, you also do something that I really love here that I think is you mirror the town to this individual. And so essentially his arc is the arc of this town. And I personally am one that I do believe in this theory, this idea that you cannot divorce an individual from their environment, that we are a product of the environment and we impact the environment that we're in, that we are one in the same. And I love that the town is also an extension of that here as well. His trauma is the town's trauma.
Yeah. This is what I love is that, you know, you're interpreting the movie and enjoying, those connections. And that's, you know, you're my favorite kind of viewer because the idea that, well, let's face it, it's his father figure. And then you realize how his father shaped the town with this other guy in the movie. Marshall Bell plays the role. And people always, I always have fathers in my movies and it's not that I had a particular, I mean, I had a wonderful dad, but I'm interested in the patriarch and the towns and the societies that we set up. And that is, it shapes the man and the man shapes that. And I say man in particular, because it's a patriarch, you know, this is for better or worse, that's Western civilization at this point. Maybe we'll fix some stuff, but I don't know. Anyway, so yeah, this is so important. And the other thing is you let the monster speak to you. This is a monster who's he's a bad guy at night and then he's remorseful in the daytime. He's a split personality. And our culture right now is suffering from this division, this divided. We are becoming divided. And, you know, the priest says, you know, a divided house will not stand. That is sort of the theme of the werewolf. It's going to tear you apart. If you have these two realities that you're trying to reconcile. So it's a movie about suicide as well. You know, it's just a lot of problems, but it's a werewolf movie. So you get to have a little fun with all this. And then last thought was this thing in the movie, Umwelt.
Yes, exactly.
And the concept is that we all see the world through our physical eyes and those eyes are built differently depending on what your creature is. So everybody sees the world differently. Well, that, you know, speaks to our dilemmas in life.
Well, and it's that idea that you can only have your point of view that's unique to you. And it's oftentimes, I think most of our problems come from lack of exposure, lack of, you know, empathy, because we don't see the thing. And that's really what's going on in this film with, you know, this sort of subplot that's going on here where there's a person that's being blamed for all the violence in this small town. And it's because they don't have exposure, because they see this person as an interloper, because they, even though they invited them in, they invited this group of people in, they still don't trust. And it's just something that we did at an arm's length. And I think that, you know, when you actually embrace your neighbors and talk to them for 2 minutes and stop looking at them as the sort of the outsider, you get a lot better. And I'm like this, I am about as left-wing as they come. And I have to do work in understanding people that have different opinions in mind, people that have more conservative ideas. I need to ask more questions instead of try to preach at them.
You find commonality because there's much more commonality than our media landscape suggests. And that's actually another tragedy. We're doing this to ourselves. We don't, you know, you bring over the electrician and, you know, he's got the Trump sticker and you're going to chat with him and you have he's worried about his dad and whether his, you know, garden is going to come out this year. These are things. It's actually a disservice that our media environment is destroying us, you know, just to make a buck because it's more sensational to have us bitching at each other. And obviously social media is ruining everything. But much more important is you, both your dogs came in while you were talking.
Yeah.
And one was the bunny because he was big, and then he disappeared. And then suddenly there was this little one. So I was having a lovely time.
Yeah, I have two dogs. One of them's 70 pounds and one of them's like 15 pounds. So they're a little bit of everything. That's how I try to live my life. Variety is important.
Exactly.
So, yeah, and they'll probably come back in and check in a little bit, but that's just, you know, what they do. Could you talk a little bit about one thing? I think that I was always attracted to genre films, probably for the same reason that you are. It's the everything we're talking about today. It's that you can put all these things into them without being direct. And so you're not getting on a soapbox, but you can deal with thoughtful sort of themes and subject matters, and you can be transgressive without, you know, horror audiences are receptive to that. And I think, you know, I'm 47. So when I saw The Addiction, you know, when I was in high school, that was one that just cracked my brain open about this type of film. And I've just been always looking for the weird shit that people are doing off in the corners, because that's my favorite stuff.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, it's such a great genre. And as you say, it's a way to, and it's perfect for the national conversation now, because it's always been about marginal characters. And now we're getting a resurgence of queer cinema and queer horror and whatever other kind of whatever marginal stuff. And obviously Get Out was such an important movie because it was right on the nose, I guess, about racism, but also such a charming film. And, you know, so, yeah, this is a nice moment. And I would say horror has always been waiting, you know. It's always been a welcome place for freaks and just people who are despairing, and people who also, I think, just like the aesthetics, or are keyed into, you know, the creaking tree and the moon and the eclipse and just all the things that nature has to offer in tooth and claw. Oh, there's your little guy back, nature. He said, "I'm coming in my kids." So, you know, this is. I just think, you know, it's such a rich genre, and we're in a good place right now with it. There's opportunities to do cool things, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And there's another film you did that you were involved in that I really adore, Dementor, because that's my son is, he's 8 years old and he's on the spectrum. And so it's something where we rarely see representation like that in a way where it's not just, it's usually in this hero worship kind of played by somebody else. And it's this idea of just, no, let's let the big bad be this. And I think it was such a ballsy movie to be made. And I think Chad, you just crushed that one. It's such a great little film.
No, Chad just emailed me 10 minutes ago with his new script and said,
let's do it.
So I'll tell him that we had this moment, and that I was talking about that movie recently just for that reason. Cause I said, I had a friend who put his sister in a movie and she had, you know, how that was so special. I think we were talking about using non-actors, and I said, well, here's something this guy did. And there's a tradition of that from indie cinemas or whatever they used to be called. But the point is, there's certain movies that had non-actors and there's a tension there. Maybe they're not as polished, but there's other offerings going on. So,
no, I love that balance of having professional and non-professional actors colliding. And especially in something, a film like that, where it works so well, because you really do have these two worlds that are colliding with each other. And there's this idea of what is reality in that film. And you're trying to figure out where does the truth lie in the story? And I think when you have performances that are kind of, you know, I don't want to say when they're not professionally shaped, they don't have those sort of tools that they're leaning into, and you get something really raw there. And I think it's quite beautiful to see that.
That's wonderful. Yeah, cool, man.
Well, Chad is, he's one of those guys that literally right here above my monitor, I have the horn from Jugface. Cause he's just,
hang on. Let me.
Yeah. That was from Jugface. That's the horn that he blows in that. And it's he's one of those guys that I think just does incredible films. And he's one of those underheard voices. And just, it's the, when I worked at a video store, it's voices like that, that I would just say, yes, this is somebody you need to watch this movie. You like these other things, these ones that are coming out, please go check this out, because I think you would really dig it.
Fantastic, man. Well, that'll be an inspiration as he gets underway with the next one.
Yeah. Okay. But getting back to yours, another thing that I love in this film and Blackout is just always being drawn to sort of the punk rock, do it yourself ethos that I see in a lot of indie horror. And there's a moment here, which one of my favorite shots in the film, I have a feeling it was probably found with the deer in the street. Is that something that was found in the moment that you just said, we have to capture that? Or how did that come together?
Well, it was take six or something. I usually don't do that many, but when you want to get a shot with the continuous. So it had a little dolly in, he takes a drink, the timing and this and that, and then he has to scooch out in there, blah, blah, blah. The point is the deer were there. And my DP was like, oh, I think I bumped the camera at some point. I said, dude, that's going to be in the movie. I don't even know what you're talking about. So, yeah. And some people think I CGI'd that because I have sort of a deer thing because of the Wendigo. And it was really happening. Beautiful.
It's great. I when you see those moments that just feel that it's that layer of authenticity, when you have people that are, they're not getting permission from extras and they're just filming it on the street and it's a stolen shot and the permits aren't there. I think there's something that comes across where you can feel that energy of people just putting together this thing and I attracted to it.
And I shot in the city when I made Habit, and the same thing. There's so many wonderful moments that were captured just with a rock and roll camera and we were living in the zone and I like acting that way, just where you're kind of interacting with the real world and seeing what accidents come. And it's a sort of an older tradition, like Werner Herzog and so on. It's a dance with fate itself. And, even bad weather, all these kinds of things become part of your palette. And then, the whole point of, but I also am sort of a structuralist and quite rigid in my thinking. I come from the Hitchcock tradition, so I do plan everything, but then you have a dance between the planned and the spontaneous, and then you that's where things get exciting.
Well,
I like to edit the movies. It's not, people always say you need a third eye or whatever the expression is to have some distance, and I'm like, no, that's actually where I'm making the movie. The other stuff was just gathering the material. So, I have to object. I'm not saying everyone else needs this method, but that's how I like to make films. So, you find those accidents, but then you shape them back and you have the control and all the fetishizing that Hitch would bring to a movie, all the details and so on.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that was actually something I wanted to ask you about, the idea of editing, because I do not have the ability to divorce myself from the experience of being there in the moment. And especially in a film like this, where you do have the structure is so important. Will the audience understand where we are in this moment? It's very difficult for me to see things with a new eye and recontextualize scenes and put them in a different order to create that, to kind of shift the meaning. That's something that's really tough for me. And having a fresh set of eyes is super helpful for that. And I'm always blown away by people that can do what you do in writing, directing, and editing something and putting that all together. Because I think that's just, not everybody has that ability to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I have sort of a forced naivete in my life because I just so startled by everything. So I can watch a movie and it feels like for the first time. And if you think about acting, that's what you're doing. Like, oh, I never knew you were going to say that line I've read 100 times because
it's true.
So there's a sense of tapping into your childish awe about things. And that helps you see that, as you say, you watch edits so many times, you could lose track of what you're seeing. And look, I'm not some prophet, because the fact is then I show my movies at a festival and I'm like, I often change them after I screen them with the audience. So, it is what it is. But the journey is to keep refining the ideas that started on the page and then became the shoot. And then I consider it there a continuum. Once again, this isn't how you have to make movies, but it's how I enjoy it. When you're making a small movie in particular, I'm also too cheap to hire an editor. What am I going to pay somebody to? That's part of it.
So then how are there things that you find in that screening process when you take it to a festival that you're surprised by, that you think about like going back and refining and changing and saying, oh, I should lean into this. Maybe you find moments. It seems like almost everybody finds a moment of comedy they may not have known was there until it shows in an audience, or a moment that has more tension than maybe you initially thought or anything like that.
Well, I really appreciate that, because that is what happened. I was very happy that people were laughing along with the movie when I first showed it at Fantasia. And I was very happy because I consider it funny. It's sort of a comedy of manners, you know, this small town, everybody's got a fucking blowhard opinion. They're all fucking, you know, the reality is that some of their intentions and motivations are very damaging, you know, like the prejudice against the Mexicans and all those things. But it's also just kind of absurd. So I was pleased that people saw my sense of humor. And that was a real revelation. You know, the kinds of editing I'm joking about doing are usually just some crazy shit, like I'll cut off the end, you know, or I've done all kinds of whatever, anything's possible. Like I made this movie called Wendigo, and the review I got out of Slam Dance was like the best review I'd ever gotten by somebody who just really hooked into it, Scott Foundas. And I was like, yeah, I still got to change the whole ending with the monster. So I took out the furry monster, which pissed me off. It wasn't what I wanted. And I started doing some other shit. So that was an actual reshoot. Usually it's just a nip and a tuck.
Fair enough. And then I know we're almost out of time here, but I got to throw one thing out here. Because I know you often refer to yourself as a director who occasionally acts, but something like Brooklyn 45... You were incredible in that, man. And that is such a great chamber piece of just showing what you can do in indie horror. And I such a cool little film, man. And you in particular were great in that.
Well, thank you. And everybody is great in that. And it always comes from the top. Ted Gagin set such a beautiful tone on his set. And he was very earnest about it because he'd written it with his dad, who had just passed away. All this, you know, emotional stuff. So, we were all there to commit to it. And I love all those guys, Jeremy Holm, who I'd already known from The Ranger, of course, but we became pals and we came out to do Blackout. So a great shoot, great experience, old titty.
Well, I was fortunate enough to see it in the theater where I saw it at the Phoenix International Film Festival when I went up for that. And it played so well. And it was one of those things that it's so cool to see a movie that's really just in this one room, and it has that Wizard of Oz thing where you know, you're going into color in that movie, and it's just all the emerald green and all these things that are there. And it's again, like we were talking about with your film, we're able to project so much into this, and then knowing the personal story of his dad and his, you know, history and all that. And it's just, you can see these really thoughtful horror films. So I guess just my takeaway is always just go support independent horror, because you're going to find some great shit out there, man.
Good takeaway, dude. Good message.
That's well, Larry, it's always great to talk to you, man. I really appreciate it. Hope we get to talk again sometime, because I'm always, you're one of those guys I keep on my radar. Whenever you have something coming out, I just, you have a lifetime pass. I'm always going to check out whatever you're up to, man.
That's wonderful, man. It means the world. You know, you can't do this without having a dedicated audience that really takes the work seriously. And you know, you bolster my, now I'm going to go make another picture.
Good. Good.
I'm glad that you got your eye on him too. So that'll be nice for him.
Oh yeah. No, it's an ever evolving list that's getting kind of out of control at this point of people that I'm looking for the third, fourth, fifth, and, you know, 10th film from, because I'm a greedy American consumer. I want more.
Exactly. So. No, you don't have one dog. You got two dogs. What the heck?
The fuck? Why wouldn't you have three? What's wrong with you?
Your dogs. Tell them they're very cute.
I will. Thanks, Larry. Appreciate it, man.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Stacey.
Time enough to figure you out. Time enough to write this down. Wish me luck. Give me hope.
voice crack.